Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Well, thanks for listening to Mornings with Carmen here on listener-supported Faith Radio. No, I'm not Carmen. No, I'm not Peter. Peter is with his wife. There, if you remember, we were talking about this, that he's over in Iceland right now. He and his wife are on kind of a second honeymoon after celebrating their 25th anniversary earlier this week. I'm Paul Perreault, usually in the producer's chair, but today also adding on the hat of being the host of the show, so hopefully I don't sink the ship. Carmen, we'll be back in on Monday here on Faith Radio. You know, as we start out the show, I know how Peter likes to bring in, actually Carmen does too, where in the word are you, and you know, with Father's Day coming up, I thought a good phrase, a good one, especially for us dads, especially for us who feel, boy, we've dropped the ball on too many occasions when it comes to imaging our Heavenly Father to our kids. It's often said that people get their idea of God the Father from their earthly fathers. And I don't know about you, but that is like, okay, I can't do that. I'm terrible. So is there another place I can help my kids see? And that's where I think John chapter 14 really comes in, is part of the upper room discourse. And Philip asking Jesus, Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us. And that's something we as dads want to do, show our kids the Heavenly Father. What's Jesus' answer? No, it's not, well, you got to do this, 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 and this, or No. Actually, that's not the direction Jesus was going, but I love the direction he does go. He says, do you not know me, Philip? Even after I have been among you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. And I take comfort in that because I know that in my shortcomings, I can still point people to Christ, because as Christ lived out his life, the heart he had for those he came to save, the heart he had for people, and the way he lived. I mean, if people want to know the Father, don't have them look at you, Dad. Have them look at Jesus as much as possible. That's my mini sermonette right here. Anyway, coming up this hour, we'll be talking later on with Joel Fitzpatrick. And on the Father's Day theme, he has a book out that's really, I think, going to be a great resource if you have it to for you as a dad, especially with your sons, to communicate with them regarding spiritual matters. Oftentimes we feel intimidated as dads. How do we do this? Well, I think this resource is going to be helpful for you. We'll talk about that. It's a book called Between Us Guys. We'll get to that later on this hour. Up next, though, here on Faith Radio, since it is a Friday, we do have Matt Hawkins, formerly a policy director with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, and currently studying to be we'll get his PhD, I think, in public theology. We'll talk to Matt about that and see how that's going. But also, we're going to talk about a couple of different things. Recently, presidential candidate Joe Biden, after many years of supporting what is called the Hyde Amendment, turned tail on that, changed his mind. We'll talk about that, as well as, well, this past week, the Southern Baptists gathered down in Birmingham for their annual meeting, and a lot of news coming out of that. We'll look at that and more coming up here on Faith Radio. Nine after the hour, and this is Mornings with Carmen, although one more day without Carmen. I'm Paul Perreault, guest hosting, and with me right now is Matt Hawkins. And Matt, again, you're studying public theology, and you're also...
I am.
And on top of that, I wanted to bring up the fact, dang, those pictures you shared back during Memorial Day weekend. This guy's a grilling aficionado, that's all I can say.
Oh, gosh.
Well, look good, man. When I grill, it's just basically burgers and brats, dude. And
you got to expand your horizons.
I do. I mean, next thing you know, you're doing foie gras on the grill. I don't know if it can be done, but I'm sure.
Yeah, Memorial Day weekend was we did the cedar wraps around.
Oh, yes.
and plus shrimp. So
oh, let's get off of that. Anyway, as we were mentioning, you're currently studying public theology. And that really does tie into a lot of what we want to talk about right now. Explain public theology real quickly for those that kind of go, well, I know systematic theology, biblical theology, or just theology. What is public theology?
Well, public theology is simply just a shorthand for when we talk about the public witness of the church. So what are we talking about when the church engages the outside culture? So as imagine, that could be a really broad subject matter. But my in particular interests are is to help churches better navigate a witness within the political arena, particularly policy influence. I think Christian institutions, we've too long kind of been sidelined by maybe our perception of IRS regulations and sidelined by kind of the American culture of this privatization of religion and kind of myths about the separation of church and state. And I think Christian institutions, the church in particular, and parachurch organizations really need to be playing in the policy shaping arena more than they can. And it has nothing to do with electoral politics and campaigns. And I think there's some other options out there that some people are doing very well, but I think a few people have really synthesized that to develop a framework for religious institutions in the public square that protects the institution without being taken advantage of by political parties. So that's my basic shift.
Okay. Well, it's important because as a public theologian, a couple of big things that happened. One is the meeting this week with the Southern Baptists, their annual convention, which you're a member of the Southern Baptists, and we'll be talking about that. But first, you did an op-ed in response to something that happened on the political landscape where presidential candidate Joe Biden, the Democratic frontrunner at this point, he made a major flip-flop regarding the Hyde Amendment, and that affects how public funding of abortion is done. Anyway, explain what the Hyde Amendment is. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah, so my op-ed in the Wall Street basically just said, look, it recognized what the Hyde Amendment was and then Biden's flop on this. The Hyde Amendment simply is a 43-year-old, what I describe as a scrimmage line on the abortion issue. It's kind of an agreement between both the pro-choice folks and the pro-life folks dating well back into the 70s. It says, look, given Roe v. Wade, you're kind of legislators, and again, I'm not saying this is a moral thing, but strategically for the sake of law, the assumption is that there is a right to abortion, but we're not going to force pro-life taxpayers to pay for it with their tax dollars. I agree with Barack Obama, who used the football metaphor. It's accurate in politics for a number of reasons, but this is kind of like a scrimmage line, right? Mm-hmm. And wherever we're going to go with this, you know, advancing past the scrimmage line is one way to look at it. Joe Biden has supported this.
Yeah.
For four decades, you know, and I disagree with being the pro-choice position, but on the pro-choice side of things, supporting the Hyde Amendment is entirely intellectually consistent. Mm-hmm. Not forcing taxpayers to pay for a portion with their money. Well, a week ago or so, Biden reversed on this. Their team confirmed it, and then within 24 hours reversed it.
That was the interesting part.
It's crazy. Presumably, because of leftward pressure on his party, he's in a primary, right? And he's in a crowded primary. And a week later, he has experienced a good bump within the ranks of the Democrat Party, as can be expected. But my point with the op-ed is, even though he may have some short-term gains in the Democrat primary, moving to his left, it's really going to hurt him in a general election, or it's going to hurt the party, whoever their nominee is, in a general election. We recognize what Mrs. Clinton's error was in not going to some of those Rust Belt states to campaign. And I think this might be a similar strategic move by Biden in a negative way for their party, because they need to re-attract basically Trump voters who previously went for Obama. And I don't see the party to date moderating or trying to win back moderates and Republicans, specifically Republicans who are wary of all the other baggage that President Trump has, his personal morality and the rhetoric that can be really negative and acidic. There are a lot of Republicans like that, and I don't think, basically backing off the Hyde Amendment for Joe Biden and the Democrat Party is not going to help in that situation.
Or you think there's enough Democrats? I mean, looking at 2020, basically now all the Democratic candidates, all 20, some of them that have announced mm-hmm. are backing the removal of the Hyde Amendment. And Joe Biden right. was the only holdout, and that changed quickly. But what about the rank and file Democrats? I know you've talked to other Democrats. You used to be in Washington, and even talking to members of the progressive Christian left who still had a foot in saying, you know, life issues are still important, because right now the Democratic plank is basically abortion all 9 months, and there's no there's nobody that I know of on the Democratic side who's saying, wait a minute, there should be some restrictions, or even, you know, at least don't use public money, don't use people's money to pay for something they are so deeply morally opposed to.
Yeah. The polling indicates, look, if you ask people what they think about Roe v. Wade, overwhelmingly significant majority says don't touch it. But you start to ask some more nuanced questions about restrictions within the context of Roe v. Wade, and majority Americans, including majority Democrats who are polled, say they're very comfortable with heavy regulations going back at least to the first trimester. And so there's a lot of consensus there. There's more than often is reported by the news outlets within of their own poll, right? They're not reporting all of their findings completely accurately. And at the national level, the Democrat National Committee, like you said, they're digging their heels in on the abortion thing, but their hopes on the in the state level, Louisiana passed a heartbeat bill signed by a Democrat governor, a bill that was written by a Democrat legislator. Now, I don't expect the Louisiana Democrat Party to have significant influence on the national level, but if this pro-life thing is going to be is going to ultimately dominate America, and if we're going to have a culture of life that looks back on this period of time where abortion on demand has been legalized and we look back on it with horror, we really do need this to be a bipartisan thing. Mm-hmm. And so we need to cultivate and kind of fan the flames of pro-life Democrats. It's a valiant effort right now. There's an effort to recruit a pro-life Democrat for the primary. It's a political action committee. I recognize the likelihood of that happening now, but we need to keep the pressure on. We do need a bipartisan movement, and we need to encourage that where we can.
All right. We're talking with Matt Hawkins, and we will be back. And when we do, we're going to be looking at the Southern Baptist Convention. They had their annual meetings this past week, and a lot of news coverage about it. And, sometimes news coverage is they focus on how would you put it, Matt? The sizzle, I guess, instead of...
I've been to now 17 Southern Baptist conventions, and every time you read the news reports and you're like, what conference did they attend?
Okay, we'll talk about that in just a few moments here on Mornings with Carmen. Twenty after the hour. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul Perreault, guest hosting today. Carmen will be back in on Monday, but we got Carmen's good friend Matt Hawkins in, and you got a busy day today with a daddy-daughter donut date.
That's right, donuts with Dad this morning.
Oh yeah,
my 3-year-old. Gonna be fun.
Enjoy. Probably a nice break from being at the big convention down in Birmingham earlier this week with the Southern Baptist. Now, of course, the big thing overshadowing it was, earlier this year, the Houston Chronicle doing a series of articles outlining evidence of sexual abuse by pastors and elders in various churches within the denomination, or the convention, I should say. Yeah. That topic was front and center. Tell us about that.
It was. The Chronicle reports were just staggering. This was the first opportunity since those reports that the convention had to kind of face the music and figure out what they're going to do with it. And so let me back up a little bit to kind of explain what the convention is and is not. The convention we talk about it as if it's a denomination, which is, you know,
roughly true.
Roughly true. It's different in that there's not a top-down hierarchy within the Southern Baptist Convention. The terms we use is that all churches are local and autonomous, and the convention is simply a cooperative effort between like-minded churches. And so that's part of the rub and part of the difficulty in dealing with sex abuse is because there's no top-down hierarchy, all churches are autonomous. They're basically free to do, you know, on the margins, whatever they feel led to do on things that are, you know, say tertiary issues or their own enforcement and regulation. But clearly, look, sex abuse is illegal. And mm-hmm. we have not only is the abuse the problem where we have ministers who clearly are not qualified to tend to anybody, much less be a pastor elder. But we also have the trend similar to the Catholic Church, we have the trend of, you know, if not overt cover up, basically just looking the other way. And so you might have people, abusers who were discovered and let go from a church, but then that piece of information did not follow them in their career. So you have pastors who continued to serve for years, maybe decades, in other churches. And the challenge then is for the convention to figure out, okay, what do you do to stop this, given that all churches are local and autonomous? So the convention this year took on the burden of trying to figure that out.
Okay. So I want to get to the resolution pretty quickly here. What it was actually approved of, and how is it going to be enforced?
Yeah. So in cooperation with President J.D. Greer, my former employer, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, launched an effort called Caring Well, caringwell.com, and issued a challenge to churches. And basically is providing free curriculum to churches to get themselves ordered and organized and prepared to deal with sex abuse, to deal with people who've recovered from it, smoke out abusers. And one pretty profound moment is that there was a book called Becoming a Church That Cares Well for the Abused. It's a handbook by Brad Hambrick, who's a general editor from churchedcares.com. Every Southern Baptist messenger who was in attendance received a copy of that book. And we're talking, you know, upwards, but it was probably not this many at that moment, but there were over 8,000 Southern Baptists registered for that. So thousands of copies of this book. The ERLC's fall conference is going to be ordered towards this training, which they revised from their initial plans for the year. And so the basically, we're doubling down on the evil of sex abuse and calling churches to actively pursue becoming a church who cares well. And, it's not only a sin, but it is something that the authorities have jurisdiction over. And in the midst of this, we had the ERLC had a conference or a panel discussion on Monday night and had two survivors and talked about their story with Russell Moore and with J.D. Greer. And it seemed to be a really redemptive experience. And so the convention is definitely having to deal with this. It's definitely negative. But I think for those of us who were there, I think this was a really good step in the right direction. The Caring Well Challenge is a 12-month, 8-step process of listening, learning, assessing, and launching initiatives that ensure your church is safe for survivors and safe from abuse. Each church takes the Caring Well Challenge, would commit to those 8 steps. And, it's really important to say that to implement Caring Well Challenge does not mean that you immediately think that abuse is going on in your church. We hope it's not. But it's really not something. It's clearly no denomination is free of this risk.
Right.
It's happened to the Catholic Church with a top-down hierarchy. It's happened in Southern Baptist where churches are completely local and autonomous. So it has nothing to do with very little to do with our ecclesiology. It has everything to do with sin.
There you go. I want you, we only have about a minute left, but quickly summarize, because that was not the only issue. What were some of the other resolutions and issues dealt with during the convention?
Sure. So Southern Baptists gather, and part of what we are, this is do resolutions, which is non-binding, but it's kind of an expression of what the convention is thinking at the moment. We did one to affirm the pro-life legislation in state legislatures. Obviously, the one on sexual abuse. We did one on persecution persecution and human rights violations in Korea and in North Korea and China. There was one on biblical justice. There was one on, believe it or not, critical race theory and intersectionality. Also on, controversial and obscure both at the same time. And then we reaffirmed the idea about expanding selective service to include women, which is a no-go for Southern Baptists. Unlikely to happen, of course, but there has been chatter in recent years in the federal government about extending that, and we're not going to have it.
All right. Hey, Matt, thanks again for joining us this Friday. Enjoy your donuts with your daughter, and we will
catch
you next
much.
Week.
Thanks, Paul. Have a great weekend.
All right. We'll be back. This is Mornings with Carmen. It's 30 past the hour. This is Mornings with Carmen on listener-supported Faith Radio. Hey, today is also Flag Day. Do you know where the idea of Flag Day came out of? What state? Wisconsin. Hey, high five to our friends in Madison. It all came out of an idea from Wisconsin school teacher back in 1885. His name was B.J. Seagrand. He wanted June 4th to be the date because the Stars and Stripes were adopted as the official design of the U.S. flag on June 14th in 1777. And so the idea coming out of our friends in Wisconsin. Of course, they also gave us brats. So, I mean, you know, good things can come out of Wisconsin. Hey, again, we are listener supported, and we, at the end of this month, will be wrapping up our fiscal year. We're about 15% of the way toward our goal of being completely budget finished, filled. Can you help us fill the gap and keep Faith Radio moving forward? You can give by calling 877-933-FAITH or give online at myfaithradio.com. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul Perreault, filling in for Carmen. She'll be back in on Monday. Now, in all our cultural discussion about toxic masculinity, and if you're a dad wanting to make sure you're raising your sons especially very well, helping them to be not toxic but healthy and biblical in their masculinity. Well, we're going to be talking about that in just a few moments with Joel Fitzpatrick. He's the author of a new book called Between Us Guys. So stay with us. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Why support Israel? This is Jim Garlow. Thankfully, today there are some really wonderful organizations that champion the cause of Israel and its right to exist as a nation. Christians United for Israel, Bridges for Peace, Christian Friends of Israel, and the Ebenezer Fund, just to name a few. The problem is these organizations are heavily populated by older folks. As we mentioned here before, the younger generation seems to have been brainwashed into opposing Israel for so-called social justice purposes. To be clear, real justice, the biblical kind, is of God, is important, and is demanded by the Lord. But today's social justice is rarely rooted in objective truth and therefore is often ill-informed, ahistorical, and unscriptural. The most succinct answer to the question, why support Israel, is because the Bible commands us to love and to bless her, period. This is Jim Garlow.
Thanks again for listening to Mornings with Carmen. Again, without Carmen, she'll be back in on Monday. I'm Paul Perreault, hosting this Friday. And, you know, we are getting ready for Father's Day. And with that, it brings up a lot of memories of Dad, hopefully many good for you. But oftentimes there's negative thoughts. And then in our culture right now, a big talk about toxic masculinity. And I thought, OK, as we get ready for Father's Day, and the importance of fathers and the roles of their children, especially their sons, wanted to talk with Joel Fitzpatrick. He's got a new book out called Between Us Guys. Joel, thanks again for joining us here on Faith Radio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Paul.
Okay, now you have served for many years as a youth pastor, family pastor in California, and so thanks for getting up so early to talk with us here on Faith Radio. It's even before the sun is up or something like that. But anyway,
it's pretty close.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you. You know, why do you feel? Because I noticed it in myself. I mean, in raising my kids, I had a hard time, I thought, engaging deeply around spiritual matters with my kids, especially my sons. And why do you think that happens in us guys?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons why dads can struggle to engage emotionally or even on spiritual topics. I think one of the big ones is that there's a lot of fear in dads. I think dads are afraid that they don't have the knowledge to be able to pass along the truths of God to their kids. I think that there's a fear that they're going to mess their kids up. I also think that dads live with a lot of kind of like low-level guilt that's just bubbling beneath the surface because they know they need to be somebody. And then they look at their lives and they know that they probably aren't the person that they need to be. And I think both of those things tend to lead a lot of dads so that in a direction where they don't have where they don't take the opportunity to be able to spend the time with their sons, helping their sons frame the world in light of the gospel and in what Jesus has done for us. And so I think those are reasons, two common reasons that as a pastor I've run into a lot. There's also a lot of dads who are very, very busy with their lives. They work all day long. I work now in construction, so my day starts at about 6 o'clock in the morning here in Southern California. And I go until, you know, I'm done. And so a lot of dads come home and they're just exhausted. And having good conversations, spending the time with your son to help him build his life up around the Word of God, it's something that just requires a lot of energy. And so it's hard, right? It's hard after a long day to come home and to have that energy to spend with your kid. And so, you know, I think those are common reasons why dads struggle with this.
How do you think this affects the kids? I mean, we talk about our in our culture, again, the term toxic masculinity gets thrown around. And I mean, first define that. But we do understand because of sin, there is such a thing as toxic, well, humanity and masculinity. But how do you think, because we're so busy or because we're so scared as parents, as dads, how does that affect our boys? How do you see it happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are always talking to our boys about what it means to be a man. And so our boys are being fed that information through video games, through kids at their school, through teachers, through shows that they watch, whether it's on TV or on Netflix or on YouTube. They're being fed that information on Google, on the internet, as they go on and they Google words like masculinity, or they Google words like manliness or men. And, you know, the reality is all of those things are going to feed a certain image into your kid's brain. And then it leads to a level of disconnection with their fathers. This is the one that I find a lot when I talk to kids. When I've pastored kids, there's a lot of disconnection. When I talk to grown men, there's a lot of disconnection with their dads. And the very person who should be like this rock in their lives, this steady, like, foundational human being, the steady foundational relationship, the relationship between a dad and a son, actually ends up being kind of an absent relationship. So it affects the way they not only see their dad, but it also affects, I mean, quite frankly, the way that they see God the Father, our good Father. And a lot of guys feel like God, our good Father, is distant from them, as opposed to being like what the Psalm says, where he's near, he's at our right hand. And so I think all of these things kind of feed into this conversation that goes on around masculinity when it comes to a Christian household. And then they hear, don't be a toxic man, you know, read into that now. Don't be a man who dominates. Don't be a man who uses power, who wields power to overwhelm other people. And those are all very, very true, right? Men aren't supposed to dominate things. The manliest man was Jesus, and he died bloody on a cross. It's not a matter of domination. It's a matter of service. But they don't get that service end, right? They get all of the other pieces of masculinity that the world tries to feed them. overly active when it comes to people of the opposite sex. It comes as a party person. It comes as someone who can be angry or who is violent or who, you get all of these different pictures, and some of them are good, some of them are bad. But the reality is, as dads, we have this beautiful opportunity to speak God's truth into our sons' lives about what it means to be a man and to live in light of the fact that Jesus lived the life we don't live. He died the death that we deserved, and then he was raised on the third day, and how that truth shapes and forms and changes everything.
We're talking with Joel Fitzpatrick this morning on Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul filling in today, and we're going to talk more with Joel about his book, Between Us Guys. It's a great book about, and the subtitle is Life-Changing Conversations for Dads and Sons. If you're a dad looking to find ways of engaging your kids better, I think this book might be a very good help, and we'll be talking about it more in just a few moments here on Mornings with Carmen. Thanks again for listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Paul Perreault filling in today for Carmen. She'll be back in on Monday. I've been talking the last few minutes with Joel Fitzpatrick. Joel is the author of book Between Us Guys, Life-Changing Conversations for Dads and Sons, and great idea for Father's Day. Now, Joel, as I was getting ready to talk with you, I was reading the intro to the book, and I love the fact that you talk about in one of the churches you were serving in as a pastor for youth and family, mm-hmm. four different guys who are active in that ministry, and they each showed masculinity. And oftentimes we try to categorize it. We want this big lump sum. This is masculinity. And right. You showed, no, there's these four different guys. Tell us about them.
Yeah. I mean, each of these guys are guys who God has brought into my life in various contexts. So one is my dad. I mean, my dad, Phil, is, I mean, he is just this amazing guy who loves children, who's boisterous and loud. And when he laughs, it sounds more like a high-pitched squeal than it does like a very deep rumbling voice, you know? And yet when he walks into a room, people look at him and say, that guy's a man, right? Like, that guy's masculine. There's something about him, the way that he carries himself, that is a picture of a man. Another guy, my father-in-law, Skip, is another guy who I point out. And Skip is this guy who is highly intellectual. He has multiple master's degrees. He has a PhD. He is more likely to be reading a book than he is to be chopping down a tree. And yet he loves to minister the gospel, and he loves children deeply. It's another picture of a man. When he walks into a room, people think to themselves, there's a man. Like, there's a, not just a man physiologically, but there's a masculine man. I have a buddy, Rip Pratt, who is a pastor here in Southern California, and he has this great mustache that is literally one of the coolest mustaches I've ever seen. He's a big bear of a man, tomahawk thrower, a camper, survivalist sort of guy, uh-huh. and yet is so gentle when he brings the gospel to kids. Would die for any kid in his youth group. Last guy is my buddy Wayne, who is a dear, dear friend of mine, a very close friend of mine. He loves to play music. He's very inclined towards that. You're just as likely to sing Disney tunes with him as you are a pop song, you know, one of the latest pop songs. There's something about him that's very masculine in the way that he carries himself. Point is that we can't, I don't think it's healthy for us to try to define manliness in one big lump sum. In fact, I think it's almost impossible to do that, because manliness and masculinity look so different in different guys. But the funny thing about masculinity is when a man who is comfortable in his own skin, who's comfortable in what God has made him, and who seeks to die to himself, to then give life to the people around him, when that man walks into a room, people see him and they think to themselves, whether it's, you know, actually thought out or not, but they think to themselves, there's a masculine man. Because in that way, in them dying to themselves to serve others, they're actually imaging the most masculine man that ever walked on the face of the planet. They're imaging the perfect man, the God man, Jesus. And in that, as they bring the gospel to those around them and they create safety and they create a place where people are free to be themselves, they create a space where it's okay to be led to Christ, where it's okay to be forgiven of your sins, as they create those spaces, they're actually living into their masculinity. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes awesome sense. I was just kind of soaking it in. It's like, okay, where are the video games that promote this? Where are the TV shows? I mean, you know, it's so different. And the whole idea, you're centering this around the gospel so nicely, because it is a dying to self, and that's what we're called to do, and find our life in Christ and letting that live out instead of, I guess, getting caught up in a lot of the, well, again, our cultural perception of masculinity.
Right, and I think that the question in my mind is not where are the video games that promote this, because I don't expect video games to give
good point.
This. The question is, where are the churches that promote this, and where are the men who promote this? Where are the men who, through their living, through the way that they carry themselves, where are the Christian men who then invite people to want to be like them because they're imaging Jesus? That's the real question. And that's the importance of something like having conversations with your kids about this. Because as you help them define it, you're actually becoming it. As a dad, as I had these conversations with my son.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because you developed this book because of your son.
Yeah, these are actually conversations that my son and I had. In a way, he should be listed as a co-author here, because he would tell me, Dad, that conversation wasn't that good. And I'm like, oh, no, yourself, got to change that. Or he'd say, Dad, you don't live this way. And I'm like, oh, that hurts. But it's a good hurt, because I know I need to live this way. You see, as we have these conversations, we're being changed because we're meditating on the Word of God. And where God interacts with humanity, humanity ends up changed one way or the other. And so as we interact with God and we interact with our children, we become men. And we become men in our own way, whether you're a computer programmer and you don't know how to run a chop saw. You become a man, because manliness is shown in the way that you love those around you. Or you're a construction worker and you're out slinging a hammer all day long. You can become a man in that. And it's not because you're strong and you can build things. It's because you are thoroughly convinced in your core what the Apostle Paul says in Romans 1, that the gospel is the power. It's the power of God unto salvation. It's the very core of the power of God that radically changes everyone's life around it. That's masculinity. Mm. Masculinity is the Apostle Paul saying, when I am weak, then I am strong. It's Jesus saying, I didn't come to serve or to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many. That's masculinity. It's laying down our lives so that the people around us can live and flourish.
Oh, yeah.
That's masculinity.
Yeah. Joel Fitzpatrick's been our guest. Okay, I'm going to try and eke out one more minute here with you, Joel, because that's how much time we have. But also, I want you to talk about the book, because the way it's set up, it's not a book you go through with your kids all the way through. You have the chapter set up so it's kind of as the situation naturally arises, here's a conversation you can have with your son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's set up so that these are easy, free-flowing conversations. There are 14 talks, starting from our friendships, moving all the way through to things like love and generosity, to topics like strength, disappointment, failure, girls, sex, defending others, heaven. It's 14 talks that circle around an entire life. And so this isn't meant to be something that you just read through once and then put on the shelf. It's meant to be a book that spurs lifetimes of conversations around all of these topics. And it's meant to be done as you're out having fun with your son.
Mm-hmm. It's meant to be lived with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's if you take this along on a fishing trip and you have this conversation while you're fishing and you both read it, great. If you read it as a dad and then go talk to your son about it with the information that you have now, asking good questions, fantastic. It's meant to spur us along to talk. And I wrote it so that you can have these conversations with boys between the ages of like 5 and probably around 9, 10. But then these are just conversation starters that get you going for the rest of your kid's life.
All right. Well, I've been talking with Joel Fitzpatrick. He's the author of Between Us Skies. Joel, thanks for joining us this morning on Mornings with Carmen.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a blast.
Okay, we'll be right back. You know, I got so into talking with Joel, I forgot I have a couple of books. His book, Between Us Skies, to give away. So if you can text me, 877-933-2484, your name, address, phone number, and or you can email me, too, at paul@myfaithradio.com. Another hour straight ahead here on Mornings with Carmen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.